this part of my ongoing project on the whole idea of jihad, how the concept of jihad was traveling across South Asia from the 16th century, and how Muslim scholars, Muslim scholars of Malabar, which is on the west coast of India, I hope you know that, so conceived the whole idea of physical resistance and pietistic resistance when they faced with a particular external called Portuguese. Okay, so that is the beginning of the talk, and so I conceptualize this talk into two ways, in the sense that, I mean, the first part of the talk will be actually dealing with the whole idea of jihad and the physical idea of jihad, and or rather the idea of physical jihad, and the second part of the talk will be dealing with the idea of piety, how piety as a notion emerged to counter the external and the internal facade. That is the one major theme I've been trying to examine last 5-6 years. The facade is an Arabic concept. It's a Quranic concept, which denotes disorder for an external enemy. And this is very closely associated with the very idea of facade is very closely associated with the idea of fitna. Mm-hmm. Some of you might be knowing the idea of fitna, Ibn Khaldun's idea of fitna. And in the context of India, Andhra Wing has extensively worked on this particular concept. Fitna means internal disorder. So, and I'm trying to look at how the circulation of facade or the penetration of the Portuguese in the 16th century Kerala resulted in a multitude of fitna, I mean the internal disorders, and how the scholars of Malabar, Muslim scholars of Malabar, engaged with these questions. I mean, how to counter the problem of facade, that means the external disorder, and also how to contain the problem of fitna. So that is the basic premise of this talk. So I read it that. So I said the title, The Age of Facade, Jihad, Piety, and Liturgical Islam in the Indian Ocean. So in the first part of this talk, I attempt to investigate the connections between Muslim ulama of Malabar and the general Muslim population in the Indian Ocean region, as I said. This ulama, I mean the Malabar ulama, was part of a never evolving transnational knowledge network in which various kinds of scholars and texts were in continuous motion. The 16th century, when the Portuguese arrived with imperial ambitions, this ulama conceived the importance of building an Islamic community of multiple resistance around Shafi'ite Islamic texts. Shafi, that's what generally is called. You have four madhab in Islam, Shafi, Hanafi, Hanbali, Malik. And Kerala remained, and still is a very, very dominant Shafi'ite region. And I mean, which I describe as a Shafi'ite cosmopolis, which was evolving, say, from the very early 9th century. So I'm trying to move beyond the existing historiography of Malabar, which focuses on the physical part of jihad, and try to demonstrate the multiple ways in which the ulama constructed a consistent consciousness of resistance against the Portuguese. Arguments in this part are located within the concept of facade, as I said, social and political disorder. And fitna means collapse of internal cohesion. Two major Islamic social and political categories. The ulama this concept actually attained a very specific scribal and theological significance in the Indian Ocean textual network in the 16th century. The second part focuses on Islamic mala text. Mala means garland, which is these texts are vernacular texts. That means Malayalam written in Arabic scripts. So, which is a very, very unique kind of translated language in which you have lots of ideas were, the ulama were actually engaging with a lot of issues of Muslim community from the early 17th century. This Mala text were instinctively, intimately connected with the withdrawal of Muslims from the port town, towns like Calicut from the last quarter of the 16th century, and their setting as the agrestic communities in the interior regions. The Mala text also represent the beginning of what can be called as Muslim agricultural literatures, making a shift from the dominance of maritime Arabic text. The Mala text emerged out of the interplay between new emotional and social state of the Maplas, means the Muslims of Kerala are generally called Maplas, who began to conceive new religious sensibilities in their agrarian expansion. These texts were written in a uniquely creolized vernacular language, which is also the spoken language of a large population of agrestic Muslims in Malabar. They were translated in Arabic letters with many additional signs. So I'll just show you an image of a text which I'm going to examine for this purpose. So this is written in Arabic Malayalam. This is not Arabic. So this is an Arabic Malayalam text. So I don't know why I'm sweating a lot. So I'm sorry. So to begin with the region of Malabar. So this region was ruled by different kings and feudatories. In the northern parts of Malabar, where the most of the ulema I'm talking about today were located. The Arabic text in the discussion show that the patronage of the ulema received from the region's non-Muslim elites, the Muslim ulema who were writing in Arabic, were actually patronized by Hindu rulers of Malabar. So you did not have Hindu Muslim rulers in Malabar. So, well up to 18th century. And all these scholars were actually working with the support and sponsorship of Hindu rulers. And these Hindu rulers were considered by the Muslim ulama as the protector of Islam. So they were not considered as the enemy of Islam. They were actually considered as the protector of Islam. And the whole region of Malabar was conceived as Darul Islam, means the land of Islam, which is a very, very significant textual shift happening in the 16th century, because earlier scholars, or if you actually look at other regions, for example, Indonesia, or say Deccan, even for that matter. So you find scholars conceiving this region as Darul Harb, right? The enemy of, not actually the friend of Islam, basically, the anti-Islam regions. But here you have a different set of ulama conceiving the region as the house of Islam, changing the whole narrative about the idea of Darul Islam, and considering the rulers of the region as the protectors of Islam, God-given protector of Islam. It's not something like a textual strategy they're kind of employing here. They're also giving a theological definition to the whole idea of what is a sovereignty and also the rulership. So the two principal ulama scholars I study in these papers are Zainuddin Makhthoum II, one of the major scholars of the 16th century, who traveled from Malabar to different part of the world. He traveled extensively in Egypt and stayed there for like 6 to 7 years. And he studied at Al-Azhar University, Cairo, And he lived in Mecca for like 3 years. So here you have a 16th century ulama traveling across the world. And he also spent his time in Bijapur court. So you find him traveling and engaging with people from different courts and also from different education institutions. So you find his text, I mean, one of his major texts called Fathul Mu'in, one of the very early jurisprudential compendium, fiqhi text. So which he was, I mean, he wrote in 1575, and that text was traveling across the South Asian countries. Like, I mean, it was taught in Indonesia, it was taught in Kazakhstan, it was part of the larger Islamic curriculums in Turkmenistan. So this text was also traveling. So you have ulama, scholars traveling across the region, South Asia, Southeast Asia. You have their texts traveling across these regions as well. So you find them traveling and connecting not only Islamic ideas, but also connecting regions, connecting scholars, connecting institutions, and also connecting anti-colonial resistance movement, particularly against the Portuguese, right? And so here you have Zainuddin Makhtum II, who wrote extensively in Arabic in the 16th century. And two of his texts, Fathul Mu'in, as I said, the jurisprudential compendium, and Tuhfat al-Mujahidin, one of the very popular texts of the 16th century. And other scholar, Qadi Muhammad Kalikuti. So he was the Qadi means the jurist, the chief jurist of the place. And Qadi Muhammad was his name itself is actually Qadi Muhammad. And he was a designated Qadi of Calicut city in the late 16th century. So he also wrote extensively in Arabic. He wrote something like 25 books, but we have, at present, we have only four of his texts available now. So, and two of his texts, Fathul Mubin, and Fathul Mubin means clear victory. That is, it's a very, very suggestive title, clear victory against the Portuguese. And another text called Kutubatul Jihadiyah, a kutubah for jihad, a propaganda for jihad. And this text was traveling across the Indian Ocean region again. So you have, this is a very small text which I found it, I mean, discovered it, rather I would use that word, very recently. So you find this particular small manuscript traveling across the Indian Ocean region in the last decade of 16th century. So what I'm trying to actually look at here is the network of scholars and the network of ideas and the network of textual tradition moving back and forth into these places. So the idea of Fasad, now I am going to the idea of Fasad. The ulama in discussion, I mean these two ulama in discussion, consider the Portuguese as an adversarial external, and this the idea of Fasad emerged from their familiarity with the increasing maritime religious tensions across the Indian Ocean cosmopolis or Islamic cosmopolis, as many scholars describe this region as. The scholars mark the Portuguese disturbances with two major linguistic expressions found in the Islamic textual tradition. I mean, Fasad and Fitna. The first Islamic usage of Fasad was found in Quran itself. I mean, Quran uses the term like 56 times, and Fitna is used more than 20 times in Quran. So, And these terms are used to address the issues of different kind of external disorder or external threat, and also internal tensions or conflicts. So Makhtum II redeployed the concept of Fasad in the context of Malabar. Because Makhtum II, I mean Zainuddin Makhtum II, the first scholar in the discussion. So he, as I said, he not only considered Malabar as a Darul Islam, but it was also conceived as Biladullah, the country of God, right? Some of you are familiar with Kerala, so would be knowing the God's own country. So the whole concept actually comes from this particular text. I mean, the early 16th century text, I mean, which considered the, and of course, you will have difference of opinions here. So with the name is coming from the Parashurama episode or from the 16th century text. But you have a reference here, which very clearly suggesting that it is Biladullah, I mean, the God's own country in that way, right? And coming back to Qadi Muhammad, so he fashioned the Portuguese as the infidels who continued to unleash extensive facade in the region. In his Kutubat, he described the proliferated nature of facade through the narratives of Portuguese atrocities. So they're not making a imaginary concept, I mean, what you say, a case here. So. As Portuguese sources suggest, and many other Arabic texts suggest, so you find extensive kind of violence inflicted on the community of Muslims, not only Muslims, the people of this region. So onslaughts, tortures, and included wiping of religious signs, or orphaning children, and exhumation of graves, rapes, for example, spitting on the face. So these are the kind of the tortures Portuguese employed to colonize the region of Malabar. I mean, if you remember, I mean, you have the similar kind of happenings in Latin American countries with the Cortes invasion in the almost the same time, so in the 16th century. So you find, what do you say, extensive tortures. On the body of indigenous people, and the rape or sexual assault as a medium of what you say communication is not a modern thing. I mean, if you go back to the medieval text evidence, so you find them actually using it extensively on indigenous communities across the world. I mean, particularly in the 16th century. So enslaving and other things. So what I'm trying to say here is that, I mean, you find scholars addressing these issues in Arabic texts. I mean, these are not suggestive texts. I mean, particularly Tuhfat al-Mujahideen or Kutub al-Jihadiyya or Fathul Mu'in are not suggestive texts. They were actually witnessing text. That means, I mean, they're actually capturing what was happening around. They were capturing, and this ulema were experiencing this, not only as a person living there, but also as religious authority. So Zainuddin Maktoum II, I don't tell that, I mean, Zainuddin Maktoum II was the makhdum of another, a coastal town called Panani, while Qadi Muhammad was, as I said, chief jurist of Calicut city. So you have two major religious authorities, I mean, religious authorities here, experiencing the violence, and conceiving that violence within the framework of, what you say, facade. So, and interestingly, Hindu scholars, I mean, non-Muslim scholars of the same time, conceive the whole period as Kaligala. Kaligala means, I mean, Kali Yuga, some of you know. But in Malayalam, I mean, in the Malayalam text, I mean, they conceive this time as Kaligala. Or Durajarakar. That means, again, very, very closely going by the meaning facade gives to us. So that means, I mean, Kaligalam and facade, I mean, facade used by the Muslim scholars and the Kaligalam used by the Malayalam Hindu scholars are the same, I mean, the meaning are the same. So you find a range of scholars, not only from Islamic legal or theological tradition, but also from other tradition, using, describing the region, the time in a similar fashion. And come back to and one of the major non-Muslim text or tradition called Wadakan Patugal means Northern Ballads. So they describe the Portuguese as a Ravan using the Ramayana or Puranic images. So for the Hindus in Malabar, the Portuguese were like the Ravana, the epitome of evil, sin, dirt, and whatever vices one human being or anyone can have. Once they situated the idea of facade. And also the whole presence of the Portuguese within the framework of facade. Now they started thinking about the idea of fitna. Fitna means internal disorder. So it is very, very natural that when you have a persistent external threat in any region or to any community, so it generally or naturally creates internal tensions, isn't it? So, I mean, as you find it even today in India, or any other places, in the sense that, I mean, the threat of outsider, the threat of the other, the threat of the foreigner, the threat of the other religious communities. And that is one part, and a particular community or a region or anybody experience it consistently, it automatically creates a lot of internal tensions. And it was happening in Malabar region as well. During the 16th century. So what you find here is the presence of this external facade, the disorder, create a lot of tensions between Hindus and Muslims in the region, which was not the case before 50-50. I mean, you never had any kind of incidents of, let's say, Hindus and Muslims physically engaging with each other or considering the other as other, right? So what you find in the last quarter of the 16th century is the tension between the Hindus and Muslims, because in the last quarter of the 19th century, you find Samudri rulers or the Zamorins, the rulers of Calicut are called as Zamorins, okay? And so they considered Portuguese as, the earlier rulers considered Portuguese as a threat. The Zamorin rulers in the early 16th century considered the Portuguese as a threat. But the Zamorin rulers in the last quarter of the 16th century started associating with the Portuguese, right? For many economical, social, and cultural maritime reasons, right? So what you find, I mean, and this was not going well with the Muslim ulama. Muslim scholars were not very happy with the changes in the attitude of the Calicut rulers. So they said, I mean, this is not happening. I mean, the new Portuguese, I mean, the Calicut rulers are actually violating the kind of tradition the earlier rulers set in place. So, and the rulers are not the reason. The Portuguese the reason. So, now, of course, they have to engage with the rulers of Calicut along with the threat of facade, and the detachment of rulers, I mean the Calicut rulers, or their association with the Portuguese is also considered as fitna. Means the consistency of their presence actually created internal, internal tensions between the ulama and the rulers, who used to be the protectors of these scholars for 150 years or so, right? And that is considered as fitna. And so then now they started asking the question, how to engage with this? I mean, how to contain the spread of this facade, also to contain the problem of fitna. So they have two issues now, to control the facade or to engage with the facade, and also contain the whole issues of internal conflicts, internal unrest happening between ulama and the sponsors, I mean the rulers, happening between individuals, happening between the communities, particularly the Hindus and Muslims, and many other things. So One of the major mechanism they devised to engage with is to create, I mean, the, to produce a lot of fiqhi text. Fiqhi text means the text for jurisprudential engagements. So you find Sayyidi Maktoum II writing extensively on the on the questions of theology, questions of sexuality, intimacy, trade, profit, maritime activities, and many other things. So you find them creating a whole lot of discourses how to be a good Muslim, right? And also how to identify a bad kafir. So what you find here is, I mean, kafir means the people who do not believe in Islam, and as you know, the Muslim. So here in the jurisprudential engagements, and there is a major text, as I said in the beginning, Fathul Mu'in, one of the major compendium. Okay, so in this Sayyidi Maktoum II engaged, as I said, a lot of questions about how to, as I said, how to actually do right things and wrong things. And interestingly, what you find in this period is scholars categorizing kafirs or non-believers into two different sections, in the sense that you find them finding good kafirs and bad kafirs. That means non-believers who are good, non-believers who can be associated with, non-believers who support we can take or they could take. And the native kafirs were considered as good kafirs, right? Good non-believers. And the and in this good kafir category, Christians were included. Native Jews were included. Okay, all caste groups in Kerala was included. Alright? And the only qualification, qualification for being a good bad kafir in the 16th century was to be a Portuguese. That was the only qualification. So if you are not a Portuguese, you are a good kafir. But if you are not engaging with the Portuguese, you are a bad Muslim. Whether you do your prayers, whether you do anything, doesn't make you a good Muslim unless you fight the Portuguese and also adhere to different theological regulations, bodily or corporeal disciplining and things like that. So a proper identification of good Muslim and bad Muslim, and a proper identification of good kafir and bad kafir. So it's happening in the 16th century. So what I'm trying to say here is that these fiqhi texts try to create cultivate a jurisprudential Muslim to engage with the external facade and also to contain the internal facade, I mean fitna, right? So creating a jurisprudential Muslim was the first engagement of the scholars in the 16th century to address the problem of the Portuguese. And this part is not told to us. So scholars of many kind and many scholars who worked on the history of Malabar or Jihad, or I'm not talking about people who worked on 19th century or 20th century like Faisal Deji and all. So I'm talking about people who worked on the 16th century. Okay, so I mean, and particularly in the case of Malabar, when you find a lot of scholars who worked on Malabar, so you find them using only one part of the Tuhfatul Mujahideen, the infamous text. So if you have Google, I mean, of course I don't suggest that in the room. So in the infamous Tuhfatul Mujahideen, and it has 8 chapters, I mean actually 11 chapters. So what you find, scholars using only one chapter of this text, the chapter which is dealing with jihad. So it has chapters on miscegenation, it has chapters on intimacy, it has chapters on caste, it has chapter on marital engagements and things like that, but no one actually so far talked about that. So there is a particular kind of selective use of historical method, I mean, what you say, text, by professional historians. So that is not my concern here. So what I'm trying to say is that before Tuhfat al-Mujahideen, what happened? We have no idea. I mean, so far. The historians actually, you know, try to engage with that question, particularly in the context of Malabar. So what you find, I mean, and interestingly, Tuhfat al-Mujahideen is a very, very small text. I mean, it's like, I mean, in Arabic, the Arabic origin, it has only 56 pages or 60 pages. But Fathul Mu'in is an 800-page text. It is impossible to actually not to see that. So it's just a huge text circulated across the world in different 45 countries. And the late 19th century, it was translated into 25 languages. So, but I mean, historians actually not deal with that. So what I'm trying to say is that, I mean, there was a prehistory of jihad in Malabar. There was a prehistory of jihad in the larger Southeast Asia. There was a prehistory of jihad in the larger South Asia. I mean, scholars are not actually directly saying that you, I mean, they were just saying that straight away you go for jihad. No, they were not actually doing that. They were actually, they tried to create a pietistic Muslim body, community, or enable them to actually identify or recognize the nitty-gritty of the, or the problem of the jihad, or the complexities of the jihad, because through this jurisprudential engagement. So, so I'm sorry, so I missed my papers. So, Sayyiduddin Makhtoom, with Fathul Mu'in, he also tried to create a particular kind of, what you say, jurisprudential kinship. That means what I call as fiqhi asabiya. Asabiya is a major term, again, used by Ibn Khaldun in the 14th century. And you find Ibn Khaldun and many ideas of Ibn Khaldun used in this text. That is actually a very, very interesting thing, in the sense that you have scholars using the idea of the whole idea of fitna. You have them using the idea of fasad, which Ibn Khaldun used in the 14th century. You have them using the idea of asabiya. So you find not only this text were traveling across the world, but you find a lot of hundreds of texts from Iraq, Persia, Central Asian countries coming to Malabar. And I just make one more point. So if you look at, I mean, of course, unfortunately, you don't have the translation of Fathul Mu'in so far. So if you actually look at the text, you find more than 350 texts in the very text, in the sense that, I mean, he's using 350 scholars from different part of the world to make his, to develop his idea of, I mean, his idea of jihad, his idea of mungahat, means the marriages, and many other things. So here you have a scholar using 350 scholars from different part of the world, and this is happening in the late, the last quarter of the 16th century. Then the whole modern violent idea of, what you say, classification, you know, my country, my region, your region, my region, things like that. So, which I consider as extremely, what is it, violent and aggressive. So you have scholars actually using, scholars from different part of the world, texts from different part of the world, ideas from different part of the world, and also using them in a very, very, very professionally and also methodologically, right? So that is what Fathul Mu'in did. I mean, before preparing the communities in Malabar to physically engage with the Portuguese. So he tried to prepare them pietistically. He tried to prepare them jurisprudentially. He tried to prepare their bodily movements, corporeal movements, I would rather say. So in a way, so there was a different kind of disciplining that was happening in Malabar, jurisprudential discipline. Right? So before telling them that, okay, you go and have a war with the Portuguese. And interestingly, the last part of the story, I mean, this section, the whole idea of jihad, in Malabar, when it comes to the question of jihad, they again tweak the whole notion of Islamic jihad itself. So I mean, in our idea of jihad, or the common understanding of jihad, is it is a fight of Muslims against non-Muslims, isn't it? Right. So, and of course, I mean, this is a major contentious debate in India now. Something called love jihad. Only God knows what it is. So, but what we find here is, in the case of Malabar, scholars, I mean, they said that, I mean, this is of course a jihad, but this is not a jihad of exclusively of Muslims against the Portuguese. In their idea of jihad, they strongly invite, I mean, they made a series of invitation, a requisition to non-Muslims as well. As this text was traveling, and you have to keep in mind always that Arabic was not a Muslim language in the 16th century. It was a maritime language spoken by many people, including the Samudri rulers. It was not, an exclusive language of Muslims, no. So the Samudri, I mean, many Samudri rulers were actually well versed in Arabic language. So what I'm trying to say is that, and many Nair scholars, I mean, the intermediary Shudra community in Kerala, there were many Nair scholars who spoke Arabic, and many Brahmins were actually well versed in Arabic language of the 16th century. You find a lot of them, actually. So what I'm trying to say is that, I mean, and the scholars said, I mean, it is a jihad which consists of all communities. Hindus, Nayars, Brahmins, lower caste communities like carpenters, goldsmiths, blacksmiths, native Jews. Okay, native Jews means, I mean, the pre-Portuguese, I mean, sorry, native Christians, I mean, pre-Portuguese Christians, who were living on Malabar coast for like centuries, and the native Jews. And it is very, very clearly written in the sense that, I mean, this is a curious case of jihad, joint jihad of many communities against a particular external threat. So they actually redesigned the whole idea of jihad, moving far away from the classical definition of jihad. Hope you get my point. So in the sense that, I mean, they changed the idea of region, describing as Darul Islam or God's own country, they changed the idea of jihad, inviting people from other, I mean, non-Muslim communities, and say that you have a, this is a facade, this is actually nothing to do with your religion or my religion, this is basically against about our sovereignty. This is about our autonomous communities. And this is also about the internal cohesion between different communities in the country, I mean, in Malabar. So they wanted to have this particular, fight against them. So the next section of the talk is what was happening. This is what happening in the 16th century, okay? Early and late 16th century. So, but you have an entirely different kind of happenings in the early 17th century. In 17th century, you don't have any Arabic text in Malabar, nothing at all. So in the 16th century, you have more than 50 texts coming up. In 17th century, you don't have any Arabic text. That means there is something happened. Seriously, some political, social, and also, I would say, liturgical shift, a new religious, spiritual, patristic shift that was happening in Malabar. So otherwise, we cannot explain the complete absence of Arabic text in the 17th century Malabar. So then what you have? So then comes this text, Muhyiddin Mala. So as I mentioned in the beginning of the talk, so this is the first Arabic Malayalam text written in Arabic letters using Malayalam, Tamil, Tulu, Kannada, a little bit of Telugu and Sanskrit, lingual, aesthetic, and grammatical tools, imageries, and things like that, vocabulary, and things like that. So this is a language, this is a language of many languages, evolved from many languages. So it has something like 50% Malayalam, 20% Tamil, and 20% Arabic. So you have it's a polyglotian language which contains a lot of many lingual varieties of lingual expressions. And this text, of course, it is published in Hijra 1327. So that means 1909 or something. So this text doesn't talk about jihad at all. It doesn't talk about any kind of physical engagements with anyone. It doesn't talk about Zamorin rulers. It doesn't talk about Malabar, right? It doesn't talk about any other communities. It only talks about a particular Sufi, Sheikh Muhyiddin Abdul Qadir Jilani, a Baghdad Sufi, who is also known as the universal Sufi, the universal protector Sufi. So why this shift is happening? So like you have seen, or I tried to demonstrate that you have it's classical Islamic images, personalities, ideas coming to Malabar. Now you have a very early medieval Islamic Sufi coming to Malabar. Okay, so now he's presented as the protector of Muslims in Malabar region. So now you have a new protector. Now you have a new language. Completely different lingual expression. You have complete absence of Arabic text. So that means, I mean, as I said, there is something happened. The happened was the Portuguese, after a particular war in the last decade of the 16th century, Portuguese was completely defeated on the coast of Malabar, particularly in the city of Calicut. And they were forced to move from Calicut city. But the damage was already done. So their continuous presence actually pressurized the Muslim merchants from different part of the Middle East to go back. And once they're back, they went back, so you have the indigenous Muslims, the local Muslims, who became part of this larger Indian Ocean trade network, coming back to the rural interiors. Hope you get my point. The sense that, the Muslims from the interior who were strongly associated with the maritime trade in the last 16th century were forced to go back to the rural interiors. That means, but they were never part of the larger Arabic textual tradition. And these ulama were not talking to these native speakers who are completely unfamiliar with Arabic language. So, but you still have life there, and you still have towns there, you still have engagements happening. But here, you have a completely different kind of social system evolving in Malabar, particularly from the first decade of 17th century. So now, Qadi Muhammad, who wrote extensively in Arabic in the last quarter of the 16th century, wrote this text, Muhyiddin Mala. This is called Muhyiddin Mala, bringing the Sufi, the most cosmopolitan and most powerful Sufi from Baghdad, and said that now, since we have problem with Zamorin, the Zamorin, the rulers, and he is no longer supporting the Islamic, Muslims. He is no longer supporting the religion. He is no longer supporting the institutions. Now you need to have another kind of protector, right? So now you have a Sufi protector who can protect you from somewhere else. And this community, a new community, or aggressive community, the people who withdrew from the coastal regions and started settling in the aggressive regions or agrarian regions of Malabar, they were completely unfamiliar with this Arabic textual tradition, and this text is not written in prose style. This is a poem. This is a poem to be. This is a song to be sung. This is a poem, a song to be performed, and this is the performance. I mean, this is a text devised for communitarian recitation. I mean, singing, group singing, and the text itself became a kind of, what you say, communicative medium from the 17th century. And this particular text actually popularized or brought in or transplanted a universal Sufi to protect new agrarian front in the region of Malabar. So this is the text of the whole story. And so what I tried to say is that, been trying to say that, there were different two kinds of textual tradition. One was the Arabic textual tradition, which deals with the idea of jihad, which dealt with the idea of jihad and the idea of jurisprudential Muslim, and also physical engagement was completely replaced by Arabic Malayalam literary tradition in the beginning of the 17th century, when there was no visible, palpable, tangible physical threat against the Muslims or the region itself. So you have two traditions emerging now, and one was completely replaced by another new vernacular, what do you say, textual tradition. And the idea of jihad was replaced by the idea of piety. The idea of valor was replaced by the idea of liturgy. So that's the end of the story. Thank you.